actually talking to them about what are your health needs, what are your concerns, what can we do to improve the lives of you and your family. Working with the local authority, extremely important now. Working with them with their new public health role to look at the wider determinants of health. Look at sexual health services, for example, and how that is involved with the work of the local authority and education and so forth. Very, very important partners, as well as the new democratic oversight of the health and wellbeing boards. And of course, relations with clinicians in the hospitals, the trusts, and also their managers. If you look at the record of primary care trusts, one of their big failings was in failing to build relations with the clinicians in the trusts and have ownership of what the PCTs wanted to do in the local hospitals about improving the quality of care in the hospitals, about better integration of hospital care, social care, and community care. One of the good things to be said about the current set of reforms, if they work, is that the clinical insights and that sort of big picture view that a general practitioner can give can be matched up with the specialist insights of clinicians in hospitals, linking up through the local authority with the social care operation, and actually you start to get a really sophisticated integrated health service. So what's likely to happen over the coming few months? I just want to run through just a few of what I think may be the difficulties and the problem areas. The first one is clinical commissioning group competence. There are 211 CCGs. Only 43 of them have been passed, authorised, with no conditions attached by the NHS Commissioning Board. There's a fair few which have had legal directions given about all sorts of details of their operation. And some of them have been put on 3-month notice that either you improve or we're going to sort of intervene and take action or even take over. Now, 43 out of 211 is not a great hit rate, is it? Even within those 43, many of them have tough challenges ahead. They are taking on massive responsibilities at the same time as recruiting staff, developing teams, building relationships, getting infrastructure in there. So just getting the machinery working, never mind making a difference, is going to be tough. There are huge financial risks around these reforms. Having stripped out the specialist care on one side, public health care on the other, you're left with a 60 billion very large slice in the middle. That is the bit of the budget which is by far the most difficult to control. Because of the way that the so-called payments by results system works, the more you do, the more you get paid. Now, in times of plenty, in the sort of mid-2000s, when Labour was shoveling extraordinary amounts of money into the NHS, payment by results acted as a very big conveyor belt, taking money from the Treasury and giving it to the acute trusts. It is going to be very difficult for clinical commissioning groups to control hospital demand, which I'll touch on a little bit in a moment. Therefore, the risk of them being overspent and getting into financial difficulties is considerably greater than under primary care trust rules. Second, relations with the NHS Commissioning Board. With the old system, you had the Department of Health, you had strategic health authorities, you had primary care trusts. It was pretty much like the army. Everyone knew who was the senior person above them. It was a pretty hierarchical setup, give or take. And it was a simple system. Everyone was directly employed by the health service. With clinical commissioning groups, GPs can just walk away. If they don't wish to carry on being chairs of their CCG or sitting on the CCG board, they can just go back to working full-time in their practices. And the much more instant rewards, I think, I don't mean financially, I mean in terms of motivation and the patient contact that that gives you. The rewards with commissioning take years to come through, if they come through at all. You add that into this present culture of the NHS, which at its worst is bullying, and there is bullying in the NHS. It does feel like quite a nasty butt-kicking chain sometimes as commands come down from on high and restrain the ability of individual clinicians to do work in the best interest of the patients. GPs will not tolerate that sort of command and control culture. That's why they went into general practice. That's why they're self-employed. That's why they love working with patients outside the mainstream of the NHS. And a more than a fleeting glimpse at any list of BMA press releases will tell you, they will not hesitate to make their displeasure known. So the pushback to national control will be great, and it will be very interesting to see how that manifests itself. Will that actually help the NHS Commissioning Board deliver a freer health system? The mandate, the instructions from the Secretary of State to the NHS Commissioning Board say there should be assumed autonomy for CCGs. In other words, don't interfere unless there's something going wrong. To what extent will the NHS Commissioning Board actually be able to deliver on that promise? Monitoring quality and raising standards. If you look in Robert Francis's report, and I strongly advise you to stick to the executive summary rather than the 4,000 pages of the rest of it, you'll see in there that he's made some quite big calls in terms of what clinical commissioning groups should be doing in terms of keeping an eye on the quality and safety of providers. They can't do that. These people have got statutory limits on their overheads. They are small, light operations, and they are simply not equipped to know what is going on in individual wards, individual operating theatres. Now, if something does go wrong, when something goes wrong again, there is every likelihood that people will say, why didn't the CCG know? Why didn't these GPs know what was going on their patch? So that will be an area of fraught shared responsibility and shared blame if something goes wrong. Again, that's really down to relationships. They need to have robust systems agreed with the trusts about monitoring performance. They need to ensure that there is a culture of openness and candor, which has been on the radio this morning. And they need to be sure that the sensitivities are there, that people can feed through information. This is really difficult, complicated stuff. The pressure and time on GP commissioners. The GP world is somewhat guilty of crying wolf about the pressure on them. But on this occasion, the wolf might be coming. You can't be a GP commissioner in less than absolute bare minimum for a couple of days a week. GPs tell me you can't be a GP less than a couple of days a week. You know, one day a week you'd be sort of really pushing it in terms of keeping up your quality of practice and competence. So essentially you're going to be doing sort of 2, 3 or 4 day a week jobs a week. The pressures there are obvious. At the worst, you know, will there be a risk of a medical error by a GP simply through lack of focus on tiredness? I don't know. You know, these things are serious issues, because I think they will be trying to do a great workload under difficult circumstances. Reconfiguring services. There was a fantastically, I hope you're not in the room, do shout if you are, there's a fantastically naive interview with a Manchester GP on the radio a couple of days ago, and he got involved in his clinical commissioning group, and then he decided to quit. And he said, well, we wanted to sort out this new sort of community-based maternity service. And then I found that I'd have to shut something else to do it. Oh, yeah, I'm not doing that. So he's taken his money, he's gone home. I mean, what did he expect? Did he think there's a big sort of pot of money waiting to be spent? Improving services, and particularly improving community services, means shutting stuff. And it means shutting hospital services, probably. And as you will all know, shutting hospital services is really, really, really difficult. Why people would prefer to be in hospital than be at home, I've never quite got the hang of it. But it is nonetheless, as I think Nigel Lawson said, the NHS nearest thing to a religion that we have. It is extremely difficult sell to shut hospital services. Primary care trusts, with some honourable exceptions, have often massively misjudged the way that they've communicated these changes. Rather than talk with the public from the beginning of the conversation, working with them, what are your health needs? What sort of service would you like? What would you like for yourself, your parents, in terms of living independently for as long as healthy as possible? Then you start to get to service which is built around community needs rather than shunting people into hospital for the convenience of medical testing as opposed to any clinical need. If you just say, we're going to shut these wards, what do you think about it? You're going to get a lot of pushback there. So there needs to be a great deal of sophisticated communication from the CCGs in terms of communicating their vision from the beginning with local people and engaging them in building belief and trust in that process. Conflicts of interest. I fear this is going to fill up more than a few pages of regional and local newspapers. The BMJ published some research a couple of weeks back which showed that 36% of GPs on clinical commissioning group boards have financial interests in private health companies. Now, these might be doing small diagnostic and minor surgery setups locally, or it could be financial interest in one of the big national healthcare providers. Either way you cut it, that is a conflict of interest. Now, bearing in mind a lot of the improvements that we're looking for, we're going to be moving care out of hospital into the community. In a sort of neutral world, you'd actually want to be investing in the precisely the services that these CCG board members have got their money tied up in. And through no fault of their own, they didn't ask for these responsibilities, they are now in a position where they are severely conflicted. To make matters worse, GPs, from what I've picked up, have a really slim grasp of issues around governance. So people who are familiar with local government, it's just instinctive about understanding about governance, about transparency, about open decision making and so forth. And GPs, through a combination, and this is not their fault, of being financially compromised, of perhaps not being up to speed with the rigors and risks around governance and freedom of information and open decision making, could get themselves into considerable difficulties. And even if it's not them directly, it could well be their colleagues, their friends and so forth that they're making decisions about, which will be to their financial better interests. Very, very difficult area, and I think it's going to be a big problem. Royal College of General Practitioners, serious concern about it. Competition law. There's been a lot of to-ing and fro-ing about this. It's one of those things that sort of makes your brain bleed, really. But it's to do with what's called the Section 75 regulations, which is a bit of the Health and Social Care Reform Act, about competition. So the government put the competition laws out. There was an uproar. They've now rewritten these competition laws. It is still very, very unclear as to the extent to which commissioners are going to have to put services out to tender. The government is saying that they will not be compelled. A lot of people, including myself, believe that that is far from true. You've got the mixture of that law. You've got EU competition law. You've got Monitor, the market regulator, looking at whether or not competition is being compromised. You've got the Office of Fair Training has recently sort of decided to stick its oar in and make this even more complicated. So to what extent the private sector is going to be involved in all this is unclear. The big problem is probably not they're going to be forced to contract out a load of stuff. It's just that there's going to be enormous resources and effort tied up in pointless tendering of contracts, when in fact they should be focusing on what they need to be doing for their patients. I firmly believe the private sector has a really, really important role to play in the health service, particularly about in the sort of whole management jargon, disruptive innovation, bringing new ideas. I mean, some really fascinating stuff happening in countries like Brazil and India around high-quality, low-cost surgical techniques, for example. I think it would be fantastic if a couple of those companies started to come over here and started to sort of really challenge our thinking about the way we do things. But you don't want to do it as a dogmatic, ideologically based approach. You want commissioners to be able to do what's right for their patients. Then GPs rebelling. They might rebel against each other. So you might have the GP commissioners on one side, and then the local GP, represented by their local medical committee, the LMC, on the other, actually at loggerheads, because the CCG is dumping more work on its the local GPs, or some dispute about policy or whatever. But be in no doubt, there will be areas where that relationship becomes very fraught and difficult. GPs could very much rebel against government policy, as I sort of intimated earlier on. They do not have the hierarchical constraints of the old primary care trusts, and they will be speaking out about the impact of cuts, about the impact of closures and so forth, in a way that has really not happened before. And you couple that up with the talk now about a duty of candour in the rest of the NHS, and there's going to be some really difficult conversations going on, which the government will struggle to contain and to answer. And finally, relations with the local council. There are many good things about this new democratic oversight of the NHS, the role of the health and wellbeing boards, bringing that democratic oversight, getting a joint approach between the health service and the NHS, so health service and local government about the needs of the area and how to meet them. And of course, in many areas, this has happened already. There's, I think, over 80 public health directors already joint appointments between the NHS and local government. But nonetheless, that strengthening could be a real benefit in terms of getting better outcomes, better integration and so forth. But it could clearly lead to significant conflicts as well. Local government works on the electoral cycle, health service doesn't. The public health responsibilities now go to local government, and GPs will tend to be evidence-based, data-driven. Politics is many things, but evidence and data are only sort of part of the spectrum of decision-making, I think I can safely say. So there is room for conflict there. I think more often, though, it will be a beneficial and strong relationship. So just to conclude, do I think clinical commissioning groups will succeed? Don't underestimate the disruption, the loss of corporate memory, the difficulty in establishing new systems and particularly new relationships. That is part of the changes that are going on in the next few days. Success in commissioning is measured in years, not in months. PCTs existed for about a dozen years. That was nowhere near long enough to demonstrate if they can make a difference. Health inequalities is perhaps the strongest example of that. Hundreds of millions of pounds have been spent on closing the gap on health inequalities in the last decade. It has failed to move the dial in any way perceptibly in terms of life expectancy and years of healthy life in the poorest parts of the country compared with the more affluent parts. There will be parts of this new system which I think work brilliantly. There will be some areas where the relationships between the clinical commissioners, the GPs, the clinicians in the hospitals, the public, and the local authority work in a really holistic, integrated, positive way. And I think you will see some of them do something quite special in terms of integrating care, in terms of having yet another go at closing the gap in health inequalities. And when they do that, those areas will be sold as evidence that the system works. The trouble is that for a public system to work, it has to work for the mass of the areas. It can't just work out for the high-performing outliers. And I really do strongly question whether or not the move to clinical commissioning will produce a demonstrable step change improvement in the outcomes for patients. And of course, it was difficult enough when the money was in plenty. Thanks a lot.
You're going to take a couple of questions,
sure.
Richard. Are there any burning questions, sir?
My name's Richard Grimes. I write for Boss Comedy and the Richard Blogger. I'm also involved locally, I come from Warwickshire, so I'm involved as an elected foundation trust governor, a patient representative on my CCG, and I also turn up at the moment at the public for the Health and Wellbeing Board. Very tedious that is, actually. One thing that you didn't come point across is commissioning support units.
Right.
These are not statutory bodies.